In his commentary on 1 and 2 Samuel, Walter Brueggemann makes the bold claim that this text from 2 Samuel 7 is the centerpiece to the whole of the Samuel corpus, books 1 and 2, and is a crucial text for the church to pay attention to in this day and age as well. As we come to this chapter, we know that David is riding the crest of the wave. He's gotten rid of his enemies. Those who oppose David are dead or silent. His approval ratings are sky high from the Israelites. And it's probably true that David could, at this point, do pretty much whatever he wanted, and he'd get away with it. The people trust him enough that if he issued a decree, an edict, or declared some new set of laws, they would assume, initially at least, if not over the long haul, that this was for their own good, and so they'd be only too happy to follow what the king said. David has not yet discovered his own propensity to let all this go to his head. That will come soon enough in the upcoming incident with Bathsheba. But we're not there yet. For now, the world was David's oyster, and he was starting to think that he could do no wrong, not even in God's sight. His pastor, Nathan, obviously believed that too. And so when David proposed that he build God a house at least as grand as the cedar-paneled executive mansion he was occupying as Israel's king, Nathan didn't even have to pray about it before giving David the divine thumbs up. Go ahead. Even God is your oyster, King David, Nathan as much as said. If you do it, God approves. If David does it, it is the will of God by definition. Nathan had probably spent his life the way most of us pastors spend our ministries. Namely, he was likely often asked to pray to God for something that people needed. Please pray for this something. Pray for my marriage or a wayward child. Pray for lab results that are due back on Monday. Now he encounters something different. Nathan encounters someone who wants to give back, who wants to do something for God. Wonderful. Finally, a little something different, a little change of pace. A believer who has turned a corner from a focus on what one needs to one who is newly focused on giving. What's more, it's David, the man after God's own heart. This is a slam dunk. No need to pray, no need to meditate on this or sleep on it or check with God on it. Go ahead, David. The Lord is with you. And the Lord was with David, and that is precisely why that same Lord had to put the brakes on here. David was about to trot down a path that may have looked as innocent as could be, but that could well have led him to the kind of arrogant self-sufficiency that could be his undoing. And that very nearly would be his undoing, as it was with Bathsheba and all the mayhem that led to. So God has to get into Nathan's face with a long oracle. There is really no missing the message here. It is not about David and what he can do for God. This is about God and what God alone can do for David. That's why Yahweh is the subject of no less than 23 active verbs in verses 5 through 16. That averages nearly 2 per verse. What David is all about is not what he can do for God, but what God has done and will do through David, but for God's glory, not David's. Of course, what God goes on to promise David is pretty spectacular. It humbles David to hear it, although it goes just beyond the boundaries of the particular Old Testament passage that we read for this morning. If we went on a little further, in verse 18, David's response to Nathan's message was to go and sit before the Lord. That passiveness of David's posture is wholly apropos. No more strutting around, no more standing up to tell God what was what and what he was going to do for God. It's time to sit and be quiet and humbly receive what God alone can give. David may be the man after God's own heart, but as it turns out, he most certainly cannot do whatever it is he wants. Even spiritually alive people, even those who not only claim to have a close relationship with God, but who actually have that kind of connection to God, even they now and then need to be reminded that God is in charge and that his ways are not necessarily our ways. David was upset that God was still living in that sorry old tent, same has been the case during all those wilderness years of wandering when the people of God were also in tents. But now that David and the others in Jerusalem were doing better and had nice roofs over their heads, David assumed God would want and need the same thing. Divine dignity demanded it. A humble tent could never do for the great God of the universe. But as it turned out, God was more interested in building David a house than having it be the other way around. And maybe the reason was because God's expectation was that it would be the house and the line of David that would one day bring to this world the incarnate Son of God who would bring salvation. God didn't mind living in a tent. As the Apostle John would one day reveal to the world, when the time had fully come, God would tent among his people yet again, and that is precisely the humble nature of that abode of skin that would finally spell the salvation of all. So our question and challenge for today is to consider how God tents among us now. How do we receive, understand, appreciate not only God's presence in our midst, but what God is doing among us? How do we peel away the layers of our own desires, our own expectations, our own longing for what we want God to do for us, and open ourselves to what God is actually doing? How can we find a way to sit quietly for a time, to listen, and to open ourselves to the very likely vision that is very different than the one that we draw in our own minds? How do we open ourselves to the ways in which God tents among us now? You all might be listening, well, what does that mean? What does that mean? We offer maybe an example. Well, I do have an example for you today, and how we as a community, I think, have responded to the way that God tents among us now, is in our midst. And that came yesterday during our workshop. Just a little background, a couple months ago, the planning group, there's planning annual meeting, they were sort of looking for workshops and, you know, what our church is doing that's good and interesting and kind of might be described as vital or interesting, that sort of thing. And I thought, well, Old South, we do a lot of lay leadership of worship now, and it's become this interesting tradition, a good thing. And I thought, you think anybody would be interested in that? And I said, well, maybe. Why don't you write up a definition and see if you can get people to come and see how it all comes together? I talked to a few people who led worship here, asked them if they'd be willing to help out with a workshop, and Ted and Cynthia and Bonnie were able to come up, and Christine and Warren weren't able to be with us, but had written up some comments and got them together. We submitted our little thing, and we, you know, who? I know there's some question, who's going to come to that? You know, lay leadership of worship. Who's going? And we don't know. So we go into our room, and a few people come, and a few minutes, a few more people come, and a few more people come, and by the time it's time for us to start, our room was just about full. Almost full. I was told later, I didn't visit all the workshops, but I was told later we were the best attended workshop at annual meeting yesterday. Lots of people there. And we talked about lay leadership of worship and how we do it, and the nuts and bolts and all that kind of stuff. And then somewhere along the way, we actually ended up mentioning our kind of open sign-up process and that we just have one committee now, and we have these open teams, and we have no deacons. And after the gasp came out that we don't have deacons anymore, anybody who wants to serve communion can serve communion. And as that set in, all of a sudden people's faces kind of lit up. And all of a sudden, they actually, it was a lot of people want to talk about that. How did you do that? How do you do that? And there were people that were writing notes and listening and asking a lot of questions. And as we were talking and as I was, you know, sort of reflecting on this, sort of realizing, right, we took a risk. And we also trusted each other. And we trusted the Spirit's presence in our midst. I know that we worry a lot about our small numbers. We need to remind ourselves all the time that the number of people who gather for worship is not a very good measure for our faithfulness. That is not how you measure faithfulness to the gospel or our ability to connect to God's presence here in our midst. Yesterday, when we were talking about some of the things that we're doing here, it was very clear that we have done a lot where we have taken some risks in faith, where we have trusted each other and God's presence here in our midst, and we have lived out a sense of God's presence here, not our own expectations, but God's Spirit here. And so as we continue to face challenges, and some big ones, let us hold on to this knowledge and this assurance that God is indeed present. But God sometimes wants us to do things not how we want to do them, but in a different way, and to open ourselves to what God has in store. Because there are times when we were talking yesterday, yeah, it feels a little bit like you're giving something up. But in the end, you gain way more than you ever gave up if you trust and are willing to take the risk of faith. Praise be to God. Amen.